Today at Reader's Corner, Pulitzer Prize-winning author David Phillips, author of Wild Horse Country, The History, Myth, and Future of the Mustang. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. From the moment we first laid eyes on them, Americans have been captivated by Mustangs, their strength, their determination, their stamina, their wild nature. They've been featured in countless Western paperbacks, movies, songs throughout the years, and we've named warplanes and muscle cars after them. Mustangs also have captivated the imagination and curiosity of today's guest, New York Times reporter David Phillips. In his new book, Wild Horse Country, The History, Myth, and Future of the Mustang, he traces the history of the Mustang in America and the challenges it has faced. He also explores the crisis we currently find ourselves in when it comes to trying to manage these wild herds. Mr. Phillips won the 2014 Pulitzer Prize in National Reporting while at the Colorado Springs Gazette for his investigative series examining how soldiers injured during war were being discharged without benefits. Since joining the New York Times, he has covered the military community from the ground up, focusing largely on the unintended consequences of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. His previous book, Lethal Warriors, explores the tragedy of PTSD that many soldiers face after returning home. Mr. Phillips joins us today by Skype for this interview. Dave Phillips, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks. I appreciate the interview.
So let's start at the beginning. What is Wild Horse Country? Where is Wild Horse Country?
Well, the easiest way to say it is that Wild Horse Country is where we are not. It is the emptiest parts of the West, mostly in the Great Basin. So some of southwestern Nevada, southeastern Oregon, Utah, Nevada, and Idaho. But also a couple spots in Montana, Wyoming, Colorado that are particularly rugged. And the reason the horses are there is that they used to cover the entire West. We're talking about millions of horses whose herds really rival the spectacle of the buffalo. But over time, their numbers were winnowed down until they were only in the most remote and rugged country, which is where there are about 70,000 horses still today.
Now, there seems to be considerable controversy over how many horses can be sustained on land which isn't exactly the most fertile. And I know you've discussed this with the BLM and with ranchers and other folks. Is there any way for us to hazard a guess? How close to accurate is the BLM's number that this land can only sustain, I think they say, 27,000?
Yeah, so if you looked at a map of the Great Basin and where horses exist, it's actually only little patchworks within the area. And so each of those patches, the government has gone in and tried to say, okay, how many horses can this land reasonably sustain? Now, their critics have said that the numbers are artificially low because they are favoring cattle production. That may be true, it may not. We can't say because it's really the only rigorous study we have to try and say what's the carrying capacity. The carrying capacity, they said, like you indicated, is about 27,000 horses. Right now, there's about 70,000 horses there because management has not been what the government would like. Now, is that number right or wrong? I think that you could ask 10 people and get 10 different answers. But I will say that underneath it is a issue that no matter what the number is there. And that is that we don't have a good way to keep a sustainable number of horses on the land that we have left. Whatever number you decide that is, whether it's 20,000 or 100,000, you are going to eventually have to find a sustainable way to keep them on the land. Right now, that's what we don't have.
Well, let's talk for a moment about the horse itself. This is quite a creature. Its stamina, its intelligence. Before we get into where it comes from, tell us about that stamina. You cite in your book some cases where these horses have just gone on for days galloping across the plain. An example or two of just how much stamina there is in this animal.
You know, what's interesting is the wild horse is not much to look at least to the horse breeder. It is literally a mutt that has been out there without any special breeding for generation after generation. But what that has given it instead is that its main breeder was natural selection. And so what you get is a horse that is a little bit smaller, but unbelievably tough and healthy and also smart because it has had to live in the desert and avoid predators. And so these horses really became the horses of legend of the West. You know, the cowboys and Indians that we hear about in stories, they weren't, for the most part, riding thoroughbreds. They were riding horses that they captured from the range. And so time and time again, you hear stories where the cavalry would try to pursue the Comanche and just couldn't catch them because their horses would always outride them. Or you hear stories about Pony Express horses, which were, you know, captured off of the Nevada desert, that could do these crazy journeys with very little water. Some of the early newspaper accounts of these animals are really astounding. Animals that could ride for days on end without stop, and animals that were entered in races that stretched over thousands of miles and beat all of their well-bred competitors. So it is a horse that is extremely tough, even though it ain't much to look at.
So what's the genealogy of the Mustang? I know there are some who claim they're not native and the Spanish brought them in, and I want you to talk about that as well. But you spend a chapter taking us all the way back to this horse and how it got into what we call the United States of America today.
Yeah, so the genealogy is very uniquely American in a couple different ways. One is that the horses that are out there today are really a mix. They are a mix of old Spanish blood, horses that got away from Indian tribes and Spanish explorers a very long time ago, but also ranch horses that might have escaped in the 70s, 80s, or even a couple years ago. And so it is a real American mismatch of heritage. But the story of where the horse comes from is also very American. So the earliest horses developed right here in North America about 55 million years ago, which is right after the dinosaurs disappeared. And at the time, they were a very small forest creature, almost rabbit-like, and about the size of maybe a cat or a terrier. And they lived in the rainforest that covered North America at the time. And slowly, as the rainforest receded, dried out, turned into savanna and grassland, the horse also changed. It became an animal that was able to live out in the open and run quickly to avoid predators. It became an animal that was able to eat harsh, dry grasses and travel long distances on relatively poor feed. In a sense, it became an animal that was really adapted to living in the rough and dry West. So it disappeared about 10,000 years ago, probably because of a mix of environmental factors and hunting by early North American natives. And then when it came back with the Spanish and other Europeans, it was still very suited to this land and the land to it. And so it shouldn't be a surprise that very quickly the horse spread all over the West until it numbered in the millions.
And so what role does the Mustang play in the life of the Native Americans? Because it sounds from your book like if it wasn't for the horse, the Native American tribes wouldn't have been able to fight off the conquering Spanish as long as they did.
Well, I think that one of the easiest ways to realize the significance is this. The Native American tribes that we remember, the ones of legend, the ones that we think of as being quote-unquote Indians, they are the tribes that most adopted the horse. They are the Sioux, they are the Comanche, they are the Cheyenne. And it's astounding how much just having the horse changed whole societies. You know, whole groups of people moved to different regions of the country where really there hadn't been many people before. They began hunting out on the plains where before that it had been almost impossible to make much of a living. And, you know, they could hunt and raid over hundreds of miles. They had this boundless energy source of grass, which they could turn into muscle and speed. But also it created a whole sort of top to bottom society where before long horses were part of their art and their songs and even their creation stories about the universe. And so it was transformational in a way that we in modern society probably cannot imagine. It was everything to them.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking with David Phillips about his book Wild Horse Country, The History, Myth, and Future of the Mustang. I was fascinated by the part of your book where you bring these Eastern authors in. Washington Irving and Zane Grey come to mind in helping us understand how our love and lore of the West is developed by two guys out east, not to mention many, many others, but you spent a little bit of time with them. Help us get that one.
Specifically, rich city slickers out east really helped develop the idea, the legend of the wild horse. So, and I don't know if readers feel this way, but I always have said, even if you've never seen a wild horse, if you're an American, you know what they mean. They're this symbol of defiance and liberty and independence that is kind of a uniquely American idea. They are noble, even though they are low-born and have no special pedigree. And that is a very American idea. And it was developed in a lot of ways by authors in the East who were yearning for that type of freedom. They turned it into books. The books were turned into movies. The movies were turned into TV shows until we all knew that the good guy always rides the horse, the wild horse. He doesn't ride anything fancy. And that horse has never been conquered. It is a horse that submits willingly to the good guy only because the good guy is true of heart. So the Lone Ranger, Silver only submitted to him after the Lone Ranger rescued him from quicksand. And that idea is also kind of an American idea, something that stuck with us. Because if the horse represents America and our democracy, you can only control it through virtue. You can't take it, you can't break it, you can't force it and still have it. There has to be this willingness to be worthy of it, and then it will accept you. And that idea has resonated for generations, and I think still does.
Now, somewhere in the early 20th century, the numbers of these Mustangs were, like I think you said at one point in your book, 2 million. And that brings us to Rockford, Illinois. Now, being a former Illinoisan, I never thought that somehow I'd be talking to somebody about Mustangs, and Rockford, Illinois would find its way into the conversation. And a gentleman by the name of Philip Chappelle. Tell us what happens in this era of the Mustang's life.
Right. So if there were 2 million wild horses at one time, and now there's maybe 70,000, what happened? And the short answers to that is that railroads reached into the West, and all of a sudden there was access for industrial markets for horses. And what Mr. Chappelle figured out is that those horses could be trucked out on freight cars to the Midwest and turned into dog food. And so his factory in Rockford, Illinois, started in about 1925 and turned out millions and millions of cans of kennel ration dog food up until the 40s. There were also similar factories in California, in Texas, in Oregon, all of them sort of the same idea, using the railroads to suck this bounty of horse flesh out of the West and turn it into a product.
Now there was a guy there in Rockford who more than once tried to do something about this, and he's the first of a number of people you talk about in your book who really tried to stick up for the Mustang. Tell us about this gentleman.
Right. So I talked about how there's this American idea that's represented by the horse of freedom and independence and nobility. Well, it doesn't sit well with some folks to see that symbol of those values turned into cans of dog food. And so there's this Montana cowboy, a guy named Frank Litz, who, when he heard about this factory in Illinois, decided he was going to put a stop to it. And so he went out with a case of dynamite, tried to blow the place up. And then he was caught before this happened and sent to a mental institution. And then he broke out and tried to blow up the factory again. And that is actually a theme that has come up from time to time ever since, that there are people who are so identify so much with the Mustang that whenever they feel that either industrialists or the federal government are endangering them, they turn to, I guess, sabotage, or you could even maybe call it terrorism. I guess sabotage would be a better word, since they weren't trying to harm people. But they were definitely trying to blow up the works.
Well, let's talk about Wild Horse Annie. This morning when I was reading over my notes for this interview, I emailed one of our history faculty who teaches a course called Women in the West, and I said, you've got to get a hold of this book, because embedded in this book are four or five women who really made the difference in the years and years it took to get this Mustang protected or at least acknowledged as a major challenge for the American West. And the first one out of the box in your book anyway is Wild Horse Annie. I mean, it's also a great example of, I mean, I hate to trivialize this, but it's a great example of volunteerism, because this is not a woman that trained for what she would eventually do. She has decided to do something about something she saw.
So Wild Horse Annie, her real name was Velma Johnson. She was a secretary in Reno. She had grown up around wild horses. Her father had actually been a guy who would go out and catch and break wild horses for domestic use, which was not uncommon in Nevada at the time, in the early 20th century. So she, living in Reno, one day encountered a truckload of wild horses that had been rounded up by airplane. They'd been chased by airplanes until they were exhausted and then rounded up and put in a truck. And they were bound for slaughter. And the act of being rounded up by airplanes chased over the desert at high speed had left a number of them quite mutilated and bleeding. And she was just struck by the fact that wild horses, which at the time there was only maybe like 20, 30,000 left, were being rounded up and sold for dog food in such a cruel way. And she decided to do something about it. And at the time, really the best thing she had going for her was that she had her secretarial skills. She could write letters, she could type quickly, she knew how to organize, and she started putting together this real grassroots network of everyone from horse clubs to elementary classes of people who would stand up for the wild horse. And first she got the state of Nevada to protect them, and then she got the federal government to protect them. And it was a real groundswell for people who, again, they had grown up watching movies and TV shows about the wild horse. And especially in the 50s, something like half of all shows were cowboy shows. So there was a real connection with the Mustang. And they wanted to save it. And she happened to come along with her great organizing skills at about the same time that the United States was waking up to conservation. And so she was able to pass a law called the Wild Horse Annie Act, right at about the time that also the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act were all getting passed in this groundswell of support for preservation. So it is amazing, because she had no backing. She had no finances. She just had a good story that people were ready to hear and to carry on.
I'm Bob Custer, a host of Reader's Corner, and my guest is David Phillips, author of Wild Horse Country. The book examines the history and myths surrounding America's wild horses, as well as the crises that face them. So you mentioned the roundups, which even today are conducted by the Bureau of Land Management. I'd like you to describe for our listeners what a roundup is like, where those horses are then taken, and the control system that operates from there.
So today we use helicopters to round up wild horses. What they do is they set up a large round corral, and then there are two fences coming out from it into the desert, sort of shaped like jaws. And then the helicopter will gather up the horses from one of these big desert valleys and drive them towards the corral, into the jaws, and through the gate. They then close the gate and take the horses into the government storage system. So in the storage system, what is supposed to happen is that the horses are put up for adoption, and someone can pick one up for very little money, usually just a couple hundred dollars, and train them, use them as saddle horses, do whatever they want. But actually very, very few horses, maybe only one in four, is adopted. And so the rest go into this vast system of Midwestern pastures that the government rents from ranchers. And they will stay there, separated by sex so that they don't reproduce. They will stay there for their whole lives. We now have about 50,000 horses in this holding system, and holding them each year costs about $50 million.
And you seem to say in more than one place in your book that the way we approach this now, with these horses being separated from families, in a sense, it's an affront to the wildness of the animal, I think is the point you've made in more than one place in this book.
Yeah, so the reason I think we preserve the wild horse, why we have a law and why we spend money on a program, is that we love the wildness of it. We love what it represents for us. And yes, we love the horses too, but when you take them out of that environment and those conditions, they lose a lot of that value for us. I compare it almost to dipping a cup into the Colorado River or something and thinking that that water within is still representative of it. Of course, it's not. And so I have big problems with spending a lot of money to capture and store horses, because I think it erodes what we think about this icon of our democracy. It instead makes it into kind of a welfare case, something that is a symbol of bureaucratic misguidance. And I think if we keep doing it, people will begin to ask, well, why do we need to have wild horses in the first place?
So as I read your book, I'm developing chapter by chapter a stronger and stronger feel for supporting these Mustangs. I'm on the Mustang side, and you're going from place to place trying to get the full and complete story, and you wind up at Twin Springs Ranch, where you learn what life looks like for the Mustang and for the Fellini family from their point of view. Wonder if you could share that with us, and especially a word or two on how this whole problem was handled long before the Bureau of Land Management got involved, which really, I guess, was the result of the Wild Horse Annie Law, and what role that played then, and can it play any role into the future?
So the Fellini family had lived on this ranch. It's huge. It covers hundreds of thousands of acres, although most of it's public land. They had lived on it for generations. And in the generations before the wild horse was protected, there had always been wild horses on their ranch. And from time to time, every few years, they would round up a portion of them and use some of them for saddle stock and sell the rest off to the rendering plant, essentially, to the slaughterhouse. And it was, in the telling of the ranch family that now lives there, the Fellinis, it was just part of life. In the same way that they used the bounty of the grass, they used the bounty of the horses. And they were able to keep a stable population there without it costing the taxpayer anything. I think he thinks very wistfully of those days now, because after the law, the Bureau of Land Management stopped effectively gathering the horses in the valley where he lives. And so what happened is a herd that had been somewhere between 200 and 300 eventually grew to a herd of more than 2,000. And it had huge impacts on his ability to run cattle and impacts on his ranch. And he eventually sued and was able to get a court order to force the Bureau to keep horses more at the historic levels that his family had. Now, this turned the rancher, Mr. Fellini, completely against wild horses that he used to love, horses that he used to enjoy seeing. He now sees as really a symbol of federal intrusion and mismanagement. And I think that that is something that you will find over and over again throughout the Great Basin with these ranchers. They are very hesitant to have any wild horses and feel that the federal government has really not done a good job. They have wasted money, millions and millions of dollars, to do things that the ranchers feel they could have done for free. And in a lot of cases, the ranchers say that the mismanagement has degraded the land and threatened their livelihood. So it is an issue where overwhelmingly ranchers would love to see the horses, if not removed entirely, at least kept under very close limits.
You mentioned just earlier that many of these horses find themselves in the Midwest, where they pasture out for the rest of their lives. But then there's a story of Tom Davis, and this is a tale of the Bureau of Land Management claiming that these horses are all safe, they're removed, but you found otherwise in at least one major case.
Yes, Tom Davis is a Colorado slaughter buyer. That's how he's made part of his living for decades. He would buy unwanted horses and drive them to the slaughter plant. He found one of the sweetest deals that he could possibly find when in about 2008, he figured out that he could just buy horses for about 10 bucks a piece from Bureau of Land Management storage. Now, if you're buying a horse for slaughter at market, it might cost you $100. So paying only $10 is a really good deal for him. And in addition, even better deal, the BLM was willing to deliver these horses for free, sometimes trucking them hundreds of miles. He then would sell them to a middleman who sold them to slaughter. And this allowed him to sort of duck through a gray area and legally make tons of money selling horses that should be protected to a slaughter plant. This has actually happened. He's the most recent case, but this has happened again and again and again in this program. It happened in the 90s. It happened in the 80s. Likely tens of thousands of horses were quietly sold to slaughter. And I think that's going to always happen as long as there are horses that have value in a market that are unwanted in other places. It is going to find a way for someone who maybe doesn't have very many scruples to make money. And so it has been repeatedly a corrupting influence on this agency, and people have gone to jail for it.
And in Canada, Western Europe, Australia, it's not such a big deal when it comes to selling horses for slaughter and having a horse burger on the menu in Montreal. And I guess that leads us to the final point here, is we have too many horses. And if you don't want to slaughter them, then we have to figure out some kind of birth control. And I want you to talk about TJ Holmes. And then, of course, you can close with your final solution, which I must admit was a shocker for me, but I see where you're coming from.
Well, so there is actually, believe it or not, a horse birth control that has been used for about 30 years now in the West. It is called PZP, and it is administered through a dart. Works very much in the same way that human birth control does, except that it's good for one dart is good for about 1 year. So that is being used a little bit, although the Bureau of Land Management has never really used it because they prefer to round horses up with helicopters. And even if it was used more widely, it's not a very elegant procedure, right? Because it doesn't protect the myth that we also love about the horse. We don't want our horses to be managed. We want them to be wild. And so what I discovered, and what I think is a long-term solution that we should all reach for, is that actually in a lot of places we could probably use mountain lions to manage wild horses. This is really interesting because if you ask the Bureau of Land Management, they will say mountain lions don't eat horses. Horses are too big. And anyway, out in the desert, there's no way for a mountain lion to stalk and capture a horse. But what I found repeatedly by looking back at old field studies where people looked at either mountain lions or at wild horses is that even if those biologists weren't trying to track and document lions eating horses, they encountered it over and over and over and over again. And it always happened in the same way. You might have horses living in a big desert valley with hundreds of thousands of open acres, but there may only be a few acres where there's springs. And so the lions hang out at the springs and they eat the young, just like they do in Africa and Wild Kingdom. And in places where that is allowed to happen, horse herds have not grown over the decades. They have stayed stable. But in a kind of a interesting twist, because there haven't been horse herds growing in those areas, the BLM has been allowed to ignore them. They don't have to go in and round up, and so they never pay attention to these herds, and they never try to understand why they are in this sustainable position.
I think I've seen a report or two in the news that the 2018 budget proposal that President Trump submitted to Congress called for changes in how wild horses are managed. Could you give us an update on where that stands right now?
So I think that there are a number of conservatives in Congress who have mentioned that they would like to be able to sell horses to the market, which means to slaughter and get rid of the storage system that we have, which, as I mentioned, costs about $50 million a year. And certainly from a fiscal point of view, it makes a lot of sense. They are not the first people to have this idea. It has been proposed for about 20 years, and it never happens because politically you cannot get Congress to vote to slaughter wild horses. At least so far, they have always backed away from that. And so I don't see that as happening, although the Trump administration has in many ways like pushed things into new ground, so we'll see. But if they do, it would be quite unusual and, you can imagine, quite controversial.
David Phillips, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. This book is one I highly recommend to our listeners. You've covered all the ground, pros, cons, this and that. It's Wild Horse Country, the History, Myth, and Future of the Mustang. Thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner, Dave.
It's been nice talking to you.
Next week, Tom Nichols, author of The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge, and Why It Matters. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.